This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And do you believe that stress causes cancer? Apparently, about half of all patients do, according to Dr. Perry Wilson from the Yale School of Medicine. He says the evidence does not bear that out, and the consequences of that belief are quite negative. I'm very anxious to hear what the panel says about that. And there are a couple of stories at the intersection of medicine and politics. So first, in Alberta, it is moving to prevent people with degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's from giving advance consent to medical assistance in dying before they lose the capacity to do so. Now, this is a preemptive move because advance requests are not legal at the moment. So I'm quite curious what's behind that and what does it mean. And it's been about 20 years since Ontario first tried to institute a system of universal electronic health records. Now, that move, the first one, e-health, turned into a scandal. And if memory serves, it featured a very highly paid consultant expensing things like a muffin for $1.88, I think it was. It was so long ago that you could get a muffin for under $2. Later on in 2009, the then Liberal Health Minister, David Kaplan, had to resign because the Auditor General found that e-health had spent about $1 billion with nothing or little to show for it. A follow-up report from the Auditor General in 2016 said that $8 billion had been spent on various electronic health record initiatives. Now, 90% of family doctors use some type of electronic health records, but the problem is that most of them don't talk to each other. So now the health minister in Ontario, Sylvia Jones, is undertaking what she calls a market sounding to try again to find a universal system for family doctors. So what do you think of that? 866-740-4740. That is our text line, our long-distance phone line, our local phone line, 416-360-0740.
Now time for The Medical Record.
And since we call this segment The Medical Record, let's start with electronic medical records. And Dr. Pakis, why is it so hard and so expensive to try to deal with this?
It was hard and expensive 30 years ago. We were laggards 20 years ago. Now it's absolutely inexcusable. Every other country, including many even low and middle income countries, have electronic health records. It's so expensive because, you know, putting that technology in everybody's hands and making sure it's secure is expensive, but that's a part of doing business in medicine. It's absolutely necessary, not only for primary care, but across the entire ecosystem in Ontario. And I don't call it a system because we don't have a health system in Ontario. We have an ecosystem with all these parts that are all paid for by the Ontario government, but very separate. We need one record for everyone. We needed it 20 years ago. We need to iterate it, meaning everyone has to have the same one so we can make it better over time. And we're starting 20 years behind, but it better late than never.
Malcolm, I mean, hospitals and doctors have electronic health records, and some of them do talk to each other, but they don't all talk to each other.
That's right. I agree with Barry. This is a simple concept that's very complicated in execution. But as time goes on, it's something that's essential. And right now, to be honest, we have a pretty good interconnectedness of certain elements of the health system. So if I'm seeing a patient from Scarborough General, I'm able to access everything that happened to them at Scarborough General and other hospitals. What I can't access is anything related to their family doctors. So you have this important element of the health system, the family physician, the entry point, which is disconnected from the rest of the health system, which certainly is much more connected than it was 10 or 20 years ago. So this was a good concept when the e-health initiative was put into place, which I guess is now 20 years ago. It's going to be very expensive because you're going to have to connect tens of thousands of individual and group family doctors on one system. And we can certainly learn from the way other countries have done it. And we can also learn from the failures of when Ontario tried to do it last time. It is essential.
You worked in BC for a while. Had they done a better job of it there?
I haven't looked at this in the last couple of years, but my understanding is, well, in BC, no. The BC was, I would say, probably worse than Ontario. Ontario, like I said, at the hospital level is pretty good. It's everything that occurs out of the hospital sector that's the challenge. I think the province that is best at this would be Alberta, because what they have done is they have, when they integrated the family doctors, they gave them access to all of the information that was going on with their patients in the hospital sector, so it had value for the family doctors. The problem when we did it in Ontario with the e-health initiative was family doctors were encouraged, almost forced to put in these systems, but these systems did still not give them access to all of this other important information on their patients. So Alberta invested a lot in making sure the information existed and that family doctors could access it. And it has to have value to the family doctors if it's going to be successful.
Dr. Pakis, first of all, do you know how many different systems are in use? And, you know, you're both talking about it being very expensive for government, but don't doctors have to pay for whatever it is they use?
Yes. And that is, you know, when this started many years ago, when, as Dr. Moore said, family doctors were essentially forced to do this, they were given a certain amount of money to pay for whatever system they chose. And there were 14 different EMRs that they could choose from. And they were given some money initially, and then a couple of years later, you'll pay for it yourselves. And this is thousands of dollars. So the reason it's expensive in primary care is the government needs to, in my opinion, I think most would agree, pick one and everybody use that one and the government pays for it. And that's, you know, that's there are many steps involved there, and it's not simple. I would certainly agree with Dr. Moore. It's better, not even in the past, you know, 10 years, but really in the past 2 or 3 years, better within hospitals and many even family doctors physicians are able to connect to something called Connecting Ontario. But what that is a system that allows all of the other systems to talk to each other. And that's a reasonable solution, but the better solution is one system that has all the data in one place, and then you can access it in various different ways. I don't think we're ever going to get there here, but many other countries and systems do have that around the world. And that just makes things an awful lot simpler because you're accessing something where it natively is, as opposed to being able to see things but not touch them, as it were, online.
Okay. I have a naysayer waiting to talk. We've got Kelly in Cookstown, who is a nurse practitioner against all this. So let's hear her out. Hi, Kelly.
Hi there. My name's Kelly Lester. I run the Cookstown Clinic. I've been open for 3.5 years, 365 days a year. I see approximately 1,800 to 2,000 patients a year. I run a clinic on an overhead of, let's say, $100 to $200 a month. That is my shoestring budget, and I can see 2,000 patients a year because I am not forced as yet to go onto these EMRs. Every clinic in Ontario already has access to Connecting Care Ontario. We can see, going back to 1999, every single thing about that patient. And I'm already concerned about the privacy breaches. Every single nurse and doctor who can go into Connecting Care Ontario and already see, oh, you were just at the hospital down the street. They said, no, get out. You're just a drug seeker. We're not going to help you. People are already being stigmatized by this because of the private nature of my clinic. I'm already getting a whole bunch of CEOs, VIPs, and politicians coming up here because they know if you want to access my chart, you're going to have to rob me. You're going to have to fight me to get to it.
Okay, okay, okay. I'm going to ask the doctors to respond. We definitely get what you're thinking, Kelly. Thank you. What do you say to her?
She's right on both counts. In other words, we still have to do this, but I work in a clinic in Barrie near where she's working in Cookstown, and we see about 200 patients a day between several physicians, and we have an EMR, but we don't use it as we're seeing the patients. We have a physical chart, and that allows us to see people literally twice as fast as otherwise, and that means twice the number of people can get seen. So we all need to recognize that a downside of EMRs since they've been implemented is that it takes longer to see the patients. Now, you can argue, and it is true, the quality might be better. You'll know what's going on. It's going to save you time in the end because you won't be repeating things. But you know, she's right on that point. We have to think about it. And the other thing is privacy. Absolutely. And privacy access are going to, and speed and all these other things are our tensions. Absolutely. You know, if you're going to be completely private, you're going to have a paper chart or a little chart that nobody can access. That is going to be the ultimate in privacy, but you're not going to be able to get the best care and have access wherever you might land. Those are absolute tensions. And, you know, I work in ethics, and there's no doubt that there are compromises when you're putting in this kind of system. Where we are right now, I think we need to move forward and focus on efficiency because people do not have access to primary care. They don't have access to specialty care. We need to see more people, and we might need to roll back a little bit on the privacy piece, on overdoing the privacy piece, in order to make sure that people can get seen and physicians around the province know what those patients have.
Yeah, and I mean, like the thing that a lot of people worry about is that there is some kind of catastrophic event and the person can't speak for themselves, and maybe their family members can't, and hopefully there's a record. Malcolm, do you have anything to add to what Kelly in Cookstown said?
Well, I agree with Barrie. I think that privacy is always going to be an issue, but it is manageable. I mean, right now, everybody's access to medical information is tracked. And if you are seen as accessing information for somebody that you don't have a direct care relationship with, somebody will send you an email or come and talk to you. So, but I mean, we live in a digital world. This issue of privacy is always going to be here. But that, I don't think that prevents us from moving into the digital world in the first place. The other danger, of course, is this whole idea of these things can get hacked, information can be stolen, or in our hospital, when Epic shuts down, it's absolute chaos because all of a sudden it's very hard to function. And I think this other point is also very important, is that there are many benefits to the medical record, but there's no question if you're in medical practice, it takes longer to see patients because there's a lot of tasks which are then put on a doctor, which in the past they didn't do. It may be more efficient for the system for them to do those tasks, but it does take us longer to see patients.
Okay. And on the note of what happens when Epic, which is the system at the University Health Network, breaks down, there was an episode of The Pitt about that. The Pit, of course, a medical drama that's really, really, really good. Moving along, Malcolm, I'll put this to you first. This whole question of people believing that stress causes cancer, and what are the ramifications of that? Where are you on that?
Stress does not cause cancer. Stress can, as this article said, lead to other behaviors, smoking, drinking, etc., which will cause cancer. But fundamentally, cancer is a disease of mutations. Something, we have genetic changes in our cells, and those genetic changes can lead to cancer. And things like smoking cause cancer because they irritate the cells, cause more genetic mutations. Obesity, again, metabolic stress on the system, viruses, stress on the cells. There is no evidence that, I guess, psychological stress causes genetic changes in the cells. So it makes sense. And certainly in my practice, when I see patients who've been diagnosed with cancer, they almost always ask me, why did I get this? People like to have an explanation. And so then they start to look back to, you know, my dog died. You know, I just lost my job. I live near a high wire electrical system. So they try to attribute it to something in their environment that's happened recently. But I think the reality is that while stress causes all sorts of health problems, high blood pressure, depression, headaches, shingles, in fact, there is no clear evidence that it causes cancer.
Right. And is there something harmful in believing that it does?
Well, you know, stress is a bad thing. It's not from a health point of view, it's not a good thing. And I think the more we can do to reduce stress, it's good. But I'm not sure that it's harmful to believe that, unless it leads to some sort of strange behavioral modifications.
Right. So, you know, in public health, to answer that question, you know, we have this whole structure called the health belief model. And it is obvious, I think, to every reasonable person that what you believe about your health, what you believe causes ill health, is going to impact your behaviors. You know, I think there are very few people who still believe that smoking does not cause cancer, but there are a lot of people who have a lot of mistaken health beliefs that have real impacts on their day-to-day health. I mean, there's the vaccine piece. You know, alcohol causes cancer as well. And it's really important to recognize that. The sun, of course, and people will highlight that. Red meat. It's you know, partly about to what degree, what is ultimately responsible for cancer. You know, cancer is one of the few things that stress is not going to impact, as Dr. Moore said. You know, it does cause inflammation in many ways, which impacts many, many other health conditions. But what people believe impacts their health on a day-to-day basis because it impacts their behaviors.
Okay, moving along. I'm still trying to wrap my head around this thing having to do with medical assistance in dying. So I was unaware until I read about it that actually advance consent is available in Quebec, which means you can apply for it, and more than 2,000 people have, but apparently only a very few have actually had it. So what do you make of this procedure? That I know that when there's this whole issue about people who have very bad degenerative diseases wanting to give consent before they lose the capacity to. But on the other hand, even though there's, you know, quite a few people who got made, my understanding is that most of them really are at the very end of their lives. I think most of them have terminal cancer, Malcolm.
Well, I think MAID is a godsend for some of the patients that I deal with. And many, many of my patients have elected for MAID. They would rather die surrounded by their family than at 2 o'clock in the morning alone in a hospital room. So from a compassionate point of view, in the cancer space with incurable cancer, I think it really has been a blessing for patients. And the reason we see so many instances of MAID in Canada is because many patients and families have seen this as something that is good for them in the terrible context that they're in. This push to move it to other things, again, I'm uncertain about this. It's interesting that the cases that pushed Canada to allow MAID were actually not cancer cases. They were patients with incurable neurological diseases. And I think one of the arguments against doing MAID at the beginning was always this slippery slope philosophy that, okay, you can start to do it on people that everybody agrees it's a good thing. Does that mean you're going to start to expand it to other areas where people have mental illnesses and other things? And I think if we're going to do that, we have to have a serious debate about the pros and cons of that.
Dr. Pegas?
So I work in public health and not in cancer. So I have a bit of a different perspective on it. And I have certainly seen and heard of where it is, in fact, as Dr. Moore described, a godsend for many patients, mostly so that they can increase their control over their health condition and their life will end when they decide it will, surrounded by friends and family. What I have certainly seen is that it has changed the dynamic between patients and the healthcare system and physicians, especially in this area, in the scarcity we have in Ontario, people without family doctors waiting for procedures and all of that, where particularly older people who are the people who might be seeking MAID at some point, even without terminal conditions, who might suspect wrongly, usually, or almost always, that their physicians are sort of, this MAID is an option or treatment is an option, and they don't feel as comfortable. The trust has been harmed overall. I've seen quite a bit of that. That's one piece. And the other piece is, in academic centers in Toronto, there's structure around how MAID is offered and delivered. And I spend a little bit of time working in Northern Ontario and elsewhere, and I've certainly seen where it's not as structured at all. And in fact, even my father, who's 89 years old, still practicing physician, has some health issues, but was actually offered MAID when he didn't have a terminal condition at all. And he's a physician and understood the context of that, as did I, and was still really taken aback from it. And so we do hear of people where and groups of people and communities, in fact, particularly, let's say, religious people, religious Jews is one group where this is particularly significant, where it's created this dynamic. And it's a very long conversation, but I think we do need a bit more structure around it. It is one of the things that is always accessible to people. Cancer care might not be all the time, but MAID might be. And that's a dynamic that's really troubling.
I would have thought that it would be harder to get MAID because you need at least two physicians. But who offered MAID to your dad?
It was just part of a conversation. It's part of, and it often is a part of a conversation in an appropriate way. But certainly older people, but many younger people as well, misinterpret that or emotionally, logically understand why it might be spoken about, but emotionally don't, and it changes the dynamic. So I think we have work as a society to do about this, separate from advanced directives and children and mental health conditions around MAID. We have a lot of work to do and a little bit of stepping back potentially and thoughtfulness. I don't necessarily think the way Alberta is going is the right way for everyone or frankly Quebec. I think it has to be very thoughtfully done.
Well, yeah, it seems like that's both ends of the pole, Malcolm.
Yeah, I mean, I think to remove MAID completely would be a disservice to a lot of the patients I deal with, but I clearly understand Barry's point that it shouldn't be every time you see a doctor with an illness, they list MAID as one of the options for dealing with it.
Yeah, that might put people off. All right. I mean, I'm still not clear. It's probably a political thing that Danielle Smith is moving to include this, and she's not trying to take MAID away, but just to say it's for people whose death is, quote, in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, reasonably foreseeable, which has been sort of flexible. Personally, what I think we really need to do, if you want a real answer, is I think we need to introduce legislation, as is in many other countries, where you must offer alternatives to MAID when you are offering MAID, you know, including things like palliative sedation, aggressive pain control, so that people don't feel it's this dichotomy between aggressive treatment that's going to cause suffering and pain and MAID, but rather there's a spectrum of things. And I'm sure in Dr. Moore's practice and in folks who deal with cancer all the time, they do offer that spectrum. But I think in many situations, people see it as very dichotomous, and we need to, as a society, roll that back and be more thoughtful about it.
Yeah. I mean, again, I would have assumed that would be offered. I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Dr. Barry Pakis and Dr. Malcolm Moore, and we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we are taking a break, and yesterday I promoted the fact that we were going to talk about this continuing battle between Daniel Tate from Integrity TO and Counselor Chris Moyes, and we didn't get to it because of breaking news. So Daniel is here in studio, and we'll talk about it on the other side of the break.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, here is an updated story that we promised yesterday, but it was overshadowed by breaking news. So let's dig into the City Integrity Commissioner's ruling that Toronto City Councillor Chris Moyes violated the code of conduct, during an interaction with Daniel Tate, who is a constituent and a vocal and constant critic of Moyes. So this happened a year ago, and in response to a budgetary question, Moyes called Tate a white supremacist. No question, that's a slur. And the Integrity Commissioner ruled, yeah, that is bad, that breaks the code of conduct, but he said that there shouldn't be a penalty for the counselor because he is a racialized person. But instead of apologizing or anything like that, Moyes doubled down at calling Daniel Tate a white supremacist again and saying he disagreed with the integrity ruling. So more developments today. Daniel Tate joins me in studio. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Libby. Great to be here.
Okay, so what happened this morning on this?
Well, first off, that was a good summary of what the background is here. And the late breaking news from what I've seen on X this morning is that City Council, with Paula Fletcher's lead, who's a big Chris Moyes ally there at Council, has actually only received the report, and they're sending it back to the Integrity Commissioner for more guidance because they don't agree. This is unbelievable. They don't agree with the Integrity Commissioner's assertion that Moyes broke Article 14 of the Member Code of Conduct. So they don't agree. They think Moyes was on base. They think Moyes was in the right for calling a constituent a hurtful, terrible thing. And that's the situation we're in right now.
Okay. You say it's unbelievable. I think that is exactly what you'd expect.
You think it's on brand for City Council.
Exactly. I mean, we have this, I would say, woke, very left-wing City Council, where there's a lot of advocacy, there's a lot of talk of activism, there's a lot of talk about race. So what would you expect?
Yeah, this is very, very divisive. And when people talk about toxic politics, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about a climate where elected politicians who have the honor of public office are now operating with impunity, maligning constituents for literally just asking normal budget-related questions at a budget town hall. It is very dangerous, and it's a slippery slope to start conflating, criticizing, or renaming, which is what I did, with racism. Are 35,000 people who signed the Dundas petition all racists? Is everybody in this city, black, brown, white, and every other ethnicity who disagreed with that renaming racist or a supremacist of some sort? Well, that's basically what they're saying, and it's completely wrong. And I'm very disgusted at what I saw this morning at City Council.
Okay, well, do you remember the exact question that you asked him that prompted him to call you a white supremacist?
Yeah, in verbatim. What are you planning to rename in 2025, and how much is it going to cost us, the taxpayers? A very reasonable question, considering what they did with Dundas Square.
Yeah.
And other things that they've renamed.
Okay. I mean, you know, I have just yesterday we were talking to Kareem Assad, the independent journalist who happens to be a non-white person. And she doesn't she would be agreeing with you.
Because she's a reasonable person.
She's a reasonable person. Not everything is about race. But again, you know, it's like, what do you expect from this council, and where do you want to go from here? I mean, there are people who have gotten very exercised about this on both sides, but, you know, I look at this and I say, yeah, what do you expect?
City Hall has lost the plot. Anytime they feel like their back is against the wall or they're losing an intellectual debate, they play the race card. That's a standard playbook that has been played for many years now. Oh, you you disagree with me? You're a Nazi. You're a fascist. You're a racist. This is why politics is so toxic right now, because it's the politicians themselves and the bureaucrats and the activists who are inside at City Hall who are playing this game. It's highly divisive. And finally, someone like me comes along, shines a light on what they're doing, and now they're, you know, they're trying to counter it by saying, okay, Daniel Tate was wrong, Chris Moyse was right. Everybody who has any iota of intelligence knows Chris Moyse was absolutely off base. And the fact that his city council cronies and allies are backing him on this is very, very disappointing.
I mean, I'm thinking back a couple of years, Josh Matlow was sanctioned by the Integrity Commissioner. I looked back, like, what did he say? He, and he accused city staff of lying about something.
Yeah, Parks and Rec. They were goofing off on the job.
Well, oh my God.
That's what he said.
You might get... anyway, so that was said to be a violation. And he was docked 10 days' pay. Now, I'm not sure what kind of a remedy that is, but that seems a lot... I mean, I don't know, politicians are accused of lying all the time, whether they do or not.
So it's just a
different standard for a counselor who is white and a counselor who is not.
This, like, we have to get over all this race stuff. It's so divisive and hurtful to everybody in this city. We are one Toronto. We are Torontonians. There are so many different shades of Torontonians spanning, you know, 50 million colors. Why are people so honed in on this race? It's very divisive. And frankly, again, it's just reprehensible that Mr. Moyse not only did not get penalized, but that City Council actually thinks the Integrity Commissioner was wrong in his ruling. It's astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, I remember back when we were debating this whole renaming, I remember, and Paula Fletcher is a white lady.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Like, what? That's, remember Toronto, like in 2010, 2004, 1994, we were all just Torontonians. What, you know, like, I don't know. Anyways, over to you.
I'm going to take a call from Pat in Toronto. Now, he is a former politician, not in Toronto. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Libby. Yes, I mean, it's the fact is that this is the only way they have to, quote, I'm not sure the word is discipline or quiet people, but I would point out the municipal politics, if it's done properly, and when I say done properly, that means you have no political parties, which apparently we seem to have the NDP running Toronto. It's the
no
best
kidding.
We have the best democracy. As I pointed out before, the late Bill Davis was one of my constituents and pointed out this fact. It makes for longer meetings. But if you look at both the federal government and the provincial government, if you're a member of a party, you better fall in line or you're out in the hall. I mean, so that is one of the good things about our democracy. Yes, the integrity commissioner, it's a bit of a joke and it's a real pain. But I've been there, but I stopped some very bad things that were going on. So this, we shouldn't be too concerned about this at the municipal level, because I think at the municipal level, we have the best democracy in our country.
We do? Toronto That's City Hall? Really?
I think so, because you don't have the situation such as we have in Ontario right now, where you just fall in line and you agree with what the leader says, or you're out.
You don't think that councillors who are aligned, the left-wing councillors, have to fall in line on this?
Well, that, I'm saying that's the problem in Toronto right now. They, you know, the NDP, as I understand it, are basically controlling things because they have meetings beforehand. In most municipalities, you don't have that same degree of control. It makes for much longer meetings, but I think it makes for a much better democracy.
Right, which we don't have. Thanks, Pat. In the situation, like, so what happens next? So presumably the integrity commissioner will change his report, and you're going to be the bad guy.
Well, it's a head scratcher, because that just means this story drags on. They're going to send it back to the integrity commissioner for like a redo or a rethink. Then that puts the integrity commissioner in a weird spot, because he already made his ruling.
After a year of investigation.
Meanwhile, you could have watched the video and made your own ruling in 5 seconds. This is, again, another example of bureaucracy gone wild.
You know, there was a big story on a front page of the Toronto Sun.
They're going to have a field day with this.
We'll see. I mean, you know, I think that's also a sign of how polarized everything is.
Look, here's the bottom line. If you are an elected official, you signed up to be under the spotlight. You signed up to be scrutinized. That's the part of the job description of being an elected local politician. And if a constituent like me, a very energized, assertive constituent, asks you a lot of questions, answer them or leave the room. Don't resort to insults or derogatory remarks. It's beneath the office.
Okay.
And this is common sense.
Okay, I'm going to give the numbers out again. We just have a few minutes left in this. 866-740-4740. That is our text and our long distance line. 416-360-0740. That's our local phone line. And people, people are still digesting all of this. And Free for All Friday is coming up soon enough, as I would say. So, I don't know. I've said many times that my dream for municipal people running, especially for mayor, is that I wouldn't even know where they stand ideologically. I just want to know, can you fix the potholes and pick up the garbage and keep the pools running and get the snow cleared?
What happened to that bargain?
Yeah.
That was the deal.
That was the deal, and I don't know. Where are you going to do with this?
Well, look, what are you going to do except just make sure everyone is aware of what's going on, okay? I don't have a lot of faith that the right thing will happen and cooler heads will prevail at City Hall, because we know City Hall is a mess right now. But at the bare minimum, you know, being on the airwaves right now with you, getting the message out, this is what's going on the inside at City Hall. We are in an election year. Remember this when you go to the ballot box in October of 26.
Okay. And by the way, your latest thing was about, and this is a problem that was flagged under John Tory, the garbage bins.
Yeah.
the overflowing garbage bins. How many
I've
years
I've been very
has
outspoken
been?
About this.
Yeah. The overflowing garbage bins, and it's...
They're broken. Just,
they're broken. There's a public-private partnership that's, you know, one of many that haven't worked out that well. Okay. What would you like to leave us with on this?
Well, on the garbage bins, it was a terrible deal that we signed with a media company called Astral.
Yeah.
Why we were giving garbage duties to a media company is I still can't understand. And here they are 20 years later in an election year. And now Olivia Chow is trying to play hero by saying, oh, I'm going to make your garbage bins amazing now. Look, it's an election year. We can see what she's doing. This is posturing. We're not going to buy it.
Okay. On that note, we're going to wrap things up. And again, people, we're going to pick up on this on Free for All Friday. Daniel Tate, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Libby.
Okay, bye-bye. We are taking another break and talk about some of the worst of the worst. The CAA has launched its annual Worst Roads campaign, and the race to the bottom is going to be tough this year because the roads are in particularly bad shape. So people will be talking about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the CAA has launched its annual Worst Roads campaign, and finding the worst of the worst is going to be harder than usual this year, now that our roads are in even worse shape than usual. So let me give the numbers out again. I'd like to hear from you people on what you think the worst roads on your drive are. 866-740-4740, that is our text line and our long-distance phone line, or 416-360-0740, that is our local phone line. And I am now joined. Now, oh, wait, let me just give you some context on what we saw last year. So two streets in Hamilton were listed as the worst of the worst, and that was Aberdeen Avenue and Barton Street East. And the worst road in Toronto was Eglinton Avenue West. No surprise there. It came in as number four. So I am now joined by Teresa DeFelice, Assistant Vice President, Government and Community Relations for the CAA in South Central Ontario. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Libby. How are you?
I'm fine, but boy, you know, just even a short drive on city streets that I'm not even sure would rate is, you know, it's avoiding potholes every day that aren't fixed. That how are we going to find the worst of the worst when this year, when every road seems pretty darn bad?
I know it can be an overwhelming decision as to which road should be nominated. And so what we say is go to caworstroads.com and nominate them all. And you can come back every day and do that because there's plenty of candidates out there to get on the list.
Yeah. I mean, do you anticipate any new roads on the list? I mean, I'm trying to think, what is my usual route? I drive along Davenport for a bit. I drive along Dovercourt or Ossington. These are, you know, city streets. But again, it's like you're swerving around these really big potholes that have the potential to do a lot of damage.
We often see that people will nominate some of the bigger arterial roads, but those smaller roads or local roads that do carry volumes of traffic do show up on our back end, and we're watching them as well. Every year we have a little bit of a movement in the top 10, and I suspect that we will see some drop off this year because we've had some successes since last year, and I also expect that there'll be still work to be done on some of those bigger roads. They take longer and they appear on the list more frequently.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the top 10 from last year, and one road that I don't see there is Dufferin, which was considered the worst of the worst for quite a few years.
Dufferin goes on and off the list for sure. And I think, you know, it is a major thoroughfare. There's been a bunch of work done, especially in adding dedicated infrastructure for bus lanes. But I also drive Dufferin on a regular basis and know how bad it is. And so it's a matter of whether there are enough voices to catapult it to the top 10. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't put your road on the list. It means go there. We're looking at all of that. We're providing that information. At CAA, we talk to the decision makers because we know that about 80% of people are complaining. They're just not complaining to the decision makers who can do something about it. And that's what the annual CAA Worst Roads campaign is about. We help people get their voices heard with their municipal and provincial government.
Well, I occasionally drive on Dufferin, and I remember the first time I saw this red paint, and I didn't even know what it means, and there wasn't really any signage to tell me.
Yeah, I mean, infrastructure is changing all the time, and so we're also always encouraging the municipality to, you know, get those messages out there and ramp up communications when they change infrastructure so that people know how to use the infrastructure that they're implementing. But ultimately, you know, whether it's painted lines or not, we know that these are things that come up in people's minds. You know, a lot of the times the issues we're hearing about are cracked pavement. That's probably the biggest one, followed like closely by 1% in our survey, is followed by potholes. But, you know, when it comes to dangers, what we're hearing from our most recent member survey is that people consider potholes the most dangerous, and then a fading of those pavement markings to, you know, help guide drivers where they're supposed to be. And then you add things that people, you know, three quarters of drivers are swerving to avoid potholes. And so, you know, sometimes those painted lines do make a difference to guide people about the safety of where they're supposed to be. And so whether it's for congestion, bad road signs, you know, painted lines on the street, potholes, you can come to the campaign, the CAA Annual Worst Roads Campaign, and nominate a road for all of those reasons and more.
Okay, so first let me clarify, the red paint on Dufferin means I can't drive my car there, right?
It's a bus lane, right. It's a bus lane. They've put dedicated bus lanes on Dufferin Street, yes.
Okay, but so why weren't they more explicit about that?
I mean, I think it just depends. I would say it's hard to get communications out for sure these days. You know, not everybody watches traditional news. I think more people should hear, you know, watch Libby or listen to Libby so that they can get that information, and the city can put out, you know, news releases. They put out messages on social media because that's where a lot of people are consuming their information these days. And so there was some communications out, but it takes a while to get that information out there. And of course, it takes even a little bit longer to get people, you know, used to what that means and how to react differently on our roads.
So apparently you found that 70% of your members don't think enough is being done to maintain the roads. So I'll just put it out there. We have just a few minutes left. Let me give the text and phone line numbers again. What do you think? And why do you think that enough is not being done? 866-740-4740. That's toll free. That's text. And the local phone line is 416-360-0740. And again, I mean, if the city doesn't fix, I mean, there's a timeline that it has to fix potholes. And I can tell you that when it comes to the potholes on my drive, they have not fulfilled.
Yeah, the city itself has reported that this year they're not quite up to the same level of pothole repair that they've done in previous years. And that's probably because we had quite a bit of snow on the ground, and efforts were about snow removal. And then as some of that was happening, more snow came. But that's also the type of things that cause more potholes, that freezing and thawing. And so the roads are quite littered with potholes. And our survey revealed like that number, 69% or 70% not happy about what's being done. It's higher in certain municipalities where we know that there are bigger challenges, like Toronto, like Hamilton. And really, it's about investing in the infrastructure, keeping on top of those pothole repairs, because that does give people a sense of whether the city is paying attention and addressing the infrastructure needs.
Yeah, and the city said, I'm trying to remember why they said they're behind on pothole repair. And again, it's because, oh, the winter's been so bad. We were focused on snow clearing or snow removal. But, you know, the big, great big piles of snow only cleared, you know, a very short time ago, Teresa.
Correct. Yes, correct. Yeah. So this is where, you know, it's been probably a good month that we've really seen the condition of the roads, and new potholes or potholes that have been filled before are reopening up. And this is a concern to drivers. I mean, they're paying out of pocket for repairs when their vehicles get damaged. Like, pothole damage can cause suspension issues, wheel issues, tire alignment issues. On average, we're seeing over $900 being spent, usually out of pocket. Very few people file a claim. And in today's situation where everybody's watching their pennies and lots of, you know, financial issues, about 10% of our respondents in our survey also told us they're forgoing repairs altogether.
So why aren't people filing a claim? I mean, if you get dinged by a pothole, the city should pay up for that.
It's a bit of a process, and it can take a while. And what we've heard is, you know, people put in claims, but if there is it has to be that they were negligent, so they knew about the pothole. So they also have a pothole line that you can report what potholes are, or 311, or through social media. So, you know, we really want people to come to the annual Worst Roads campaign, but there's also other services like reporting those potholes so they get filled in faster. And if people do have a claim, they should consider whether that their claim is eligible to be put forward to the municipality.
Okay, I'm looking. We have Andreas in Toronto. Andreas, we're basically out of time. Can you tell me in 10 seconds what your issue is?
Well, basically, I have a concern because CAA is not really voicing anything about the transit system and the removal of lanes from public roadways, which has made a mess of the traffic. And yet they're saying there are too many cars, but they're taking lanes away so that buses can run. And they're still running buses on the curb lane and in the center where the LRT is.
Okay. Thanks, Andreas. I cut you off because basically I'm out of time. Teresa, I'm going to give you another 10 seconds. We're out of time, and we will pick up on this hopefully on Free for All Friday. What do you want to leave us with here?
We encourage everybody until April 17th, you can nominate your worst road or many roads that you want to at caaworstroads.com. And we appreciate talking again when the results come out.
Okay. We will talk again when the results come out, and people will talk about this again, Free for All Friday, if there are other issues like lost lanes, why aren't you trying to get your money from the city? All of that. Teresa DeFelice from the CAA, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Okay. That's all the time we have for Fight Back for today. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.